Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today, we take you to the Maine Women's Summit on Economic Security in Augusta, hosted by the Maine Women's Policy Center. Speaking today is Alicia Garza, one of the co-creators of the Black Lives Matter movement. She explains the role of Black Lives Matter in the 21st century and explores ways to confront prejudice in the United States. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and this program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. And now, Alicia Garza takes the stage.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So first and foremost, I want to thank you for having me here. It's always a joy to come back to Maine. And I know you might be saying to yourself, why would you say it's a joy to come back to Maine? When have you been here before? And I did. I had the pleasure of being here a few years ago at the University of Southern Maine to give a talk on Black Lives Matter. And also my good friend Drew works and lives here. And he tells me that this is actually the best time to be in Maine. And so when the invitation came, I said, ooh, somewhere with seasons. So I have a lot to say. And I have an hour, is what I'm told, 45 minutes. So what I'd like to do is just offer some comments and thoughts about what's at stake right now, and then have a conversation with you to hear more about what you're thinking about, what you're grappling with, and more so, how do we make a plan together to build a movement in the millions that can transform the landscape, not just of this country, right, but the way in which this country leads kind of what happens around the world, okay? So everything that's happening in the United States right now has a global impact. And so the changes on our political terrain are also having an impact globally. And so I do feel like there's an importance in being able to talk about why we have to change what's happening here and take it more seriously, because it doesn't just impact the United States. It actually impacts everywhere. And then I also just want to spend some time talking about what's at stake for women in particular, and what's at stake for feminism. So can we do that? Okay, just checking. So I want to just start off by reminding us about the purpose and the vision of Black Lives Matter. Because you'd be surprised that 4 years later, after all the talking and marching and protesting and organizing we've done, there's still a lot of misconceptions about who we are and what we're about. And in fact, the president has taken it on himself, right, to reconstruct history. I call that amnesia. But his reconstruction of history is the exact reason that Black Lives Matter exists. That reconstruction, that amnesia of calling black people terrorists, where we have the FBI recreating and reinvigorating COINTELPRO-like tactics to now create a new group of threat, which is not really a new group, they're just including more people, called black identity extremists. And we should make no mistake that that amnesia, that rewriting of history, has a purpose. The purpose is to discredit everything that this movement, that our organization, has served to lift up and make more visible. Black Lives Matter did not call attention to a new phenomenon of white supremacist violence, Black Lives Matter did not call attention to a new phenomenon of what we call predatory policing, right? These types of dynamics have been in play for a very long time. What we did is we created the space to pull back the curtain, to remind us that there's still a lot of work that we have left to do, okay? So I want to start off by reminding us about why Black Lives Matter came to be. And I want to do that by just saying that the night that George Zimmerman was acquitted in the murder of Trayvon Martin, July 13th, 2013, I woke up in the middle of the night from a troubled and inebriated sleep with tears streaming down my face because I could not wrap my head around how it was that an adult could kill a child and walk free. As I sat up in my bed, tears streaming down my face, I wrote a love letter to Black people. And I ended that letter with the assertion that our lives mattered, a demand that our lives matter, that Black lives matter, that we're worthy of growing old, of raising our own children someday, and that we're human and deserving of dignity and respect. I did not write that letter because I knew that it would eventually become the banner under which this generation marches. I did not write that letter because it was a desire of mine to be on stages like this, with groups like yours, having to explain why Black lives do matter. I wrote that letter because I love my people. I wrote that letter because I wanted to love on us when nobody else would. I wrote that letter because they call us thugs and criminals, regardless of who we actually are. I wrote that letter because too many people, the people who are sworn to protect and serve us, are literally getting away with murder. I wrote that letter because there are currently 1 million Black people in jails and prisons. And there's too many Black folks under state supervision and living in housing that's deteriorating, and too many of us that don't have homes at all, and too many of us who are being suspended from schools, too many of us who are making less than white men and less than white women, and too many of us who are being put in jail for defending ourselves against violent attackers, and too many of us who are not living past the age of 35, and too many of us who are dying just for trying to live. I wrote that letter because too many mothers are losing their children and being told that somehow it's their fault. It's your fault for not raising them better or getting them into a better neighborhood or letting them play in that park or walk alone to the store or turn up the music when somebody asks you to turn it down or shop in a Walmart or go up on a porch and ask for help or have a pool party or fail to use your turn signal as it was in the cases of Tamir Rice and Jordan Davis and Renisha McBride and Sandra Bland. I wrote that letter because as angry and as rageful as I was and still am, as much as I wanted to scream, as much as I wanted an eye for an eye, I knew deep down that what I actually wanted, what I still actually want, is to be loved in a world that does not love us. And to restore that kind of love in this world means that there could be love for all of us. So rather than waiting for that love to come from somewhere else or somewhere outside of us, I felt deeply that if I whispered in our ears that we were valuable and worthy of dignity, regardless of whether or not we were famous or could play sports, regardless of whether or not we've been to jail, we're still in jail, whether or not we got straight A's, whether or not we kicked it on the block, whether or not we are gay or lesbian or bisexual or asexual, whether or not we sag our pants or wear suits and ties, whether or not we are transgendered, whether or not we subscribe to gender at all, whether we were born here in the United States or not, whether or not we live with a disability, maybe someone else would say it too. Maybe somebody else could believe it. Maybe it would inspire someone to hold their head a little bit higher, throw your shoulders back, like you do actually belong here. Maybe it would cause somebody else to say, we're not going to do this anymore. No more Mario Woods, no more Kayla Moores, no more Sandra Blands, no more Kenneth Hardings, no more Ilan Nettles, no more Penny Prouds, no more Yvette Hendersons, no more Ayanna Stanley Joneses, no more Tamir Rices, no more Oscar Grants, no more Natasha McKennas. I can't do more of the litany because there are too many of us that are dying just for trying to live. I wrote that letter because maybe that love could inspire a new freedom dream, a new Harriet Tubman, a new Asada, another Loretta Ross, or a new Fannie Lou Hamer. I wrote that letter for all the times that woman grabbed her purse as I walked by. I wrote that letter for every time I was told I wasn't smart enough, good enough, light enough, black enough, straight enough, for every time I was told to just tone it down a little bit. For all those times they said he had a gun. For all those times they said that thug deserved it. For all the times the camera wasn't turned on. That's why I wrote that letter. I wrote that letter for my baby brother, who lives in one of the richest counties in the world. But to many, he's just a 6-foot-tall black man looking suspicious. I wrote that letter because we deserve more. We all deserve more. So, that love that caused me that night as I laid in my bed, sobbing at yet another not guilty verdict, to whisper in the night that I believed in our ability to set ourselves free. Now, that is why Black Lives Matter was created. Black Lives Matter, and it's stupid that I have to keep saying this, but I will, because I love us. Black Lives Matter is not a hate group. It's not a group that hates white people. It's not even so much a group that hates police. Black Lives Matter is not a group of domestic terrorists. These are all phrases that are used to describe a movement that is grounded in the principle that we deserve to live. Full stop. And yet the way that we describe black people in our full dignity, demanding that we have equal rights, demanding that America live up to its promise of freedom and justice for all, we're still described as thugs and criminals. And now, black identity extremists. I was honored to hear that my sister, Loretta Ross, would be here today. She's one of my heroes, and I'm playing it real cool right now up here. Real cool. But as I was preparing to come here, I started to think about how history moves in cycles. And where I'm at today is that I want us to interrupt the cycle of history that keeps playing over and over and over again. This morning, as I prepared myself to come here, I turned on the television to see stories of women talking about abuse, violence at the hands of a very powerful man. I found it ironic that this would be the top story on CNN when our president has done much worse and for longer. I started to think about how we got here in the first place. How I personally got here in the first place, and the way that I got here was that 43 years ago, Demita Frazier and Beverly Smith and Barbara Smith formed the Combahee River Collective. It was a proactive attempt to redefine feminism as it related to black women. The Combahee River Collective became necessary because mainstream feminism failed to address the unique and nuanced concerns of black women. In it, they describe the need to understand the ways in which race and class and sexuality and gender are forms of interlocking systems of domination. That when considered together, uniquely and negatively impact the life chances, the life outcomes, and the life experiences of black women. If you don't know about the Combahee River Collective, you should Google that right now. I'm being serious about that. C-O-M-B-A-H-E-E. Mm-hmm. Combahee River is a historic place. It is a place where Harriet Tubman fought for all of us to be free. Now, as you're Googling, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about the Combahee River Collective, who referred to this big mouthful of interlocking systems of domination as simultaneity, meaning things that happen at the same time. And in 1989, black feminist and scholar Kimberly Crenshaw coined intersectionality as a way for us to understand the multidimensional nature of the beast that we're fighting. And yet, 43 years after receiving these gifts from black women who loved us enough to tell us the truth about the limits of any paradigm, any organization, any framework, any movement that refused to embrace the complexity of our lives in favor of a false or shallow unity, we're still struggling over these questions, aren't we, 43 years later, in our movements, in our democracy, in our economy, we are still struggling over how do we build a world where many worlds fit. Now, when we built Black Lives Matter, We did it as a tactic to rebuild a black freedom movement that had not only been decimated by our own government, but a black freedom movement that also struggles with what it means to center the lives of all black people, black queer people, black immigrants, black working class people, black women, black people with disabilities. We work hard to make sure that Black Lives Matter is an intervention in the tradition of amnesia that continues to plague this country. The Combahee River Collective statement was also an intervention in amnesia. Their intervention was attacking the amnesia that comes up in feminist movements. It is why the legacy of black feminism has always been to define ourselves for ourselves. And yet, 40 years later, we're still asking ourselves if all lives matter, or if black lives matter means only black lives. 40 years later, we're still being asked to tone it down, to have some respect, to nurture that which we have never had access to. We're still being asked to show up without getting the same in return. 40 years later, we're still pointing to cis men as leaders of movements that we maintain, envision, and nurture. Yeah, I said that. And when we do point out that Black Lives Matter was created by three black women, two of whom are queer, one of whom is the daughter of Nigerian immigrants, we're told that we are being divisive, that we're too concerned with credit and visibility. Well, why should we not be? The contributions of women, of black women, have been erased over and over and over again. So why should we not fight to have our contributions recognized? Why should we not fight the amnesia that continues to place cisgendered men at the heads of things that they did not create? Why is it that for black women to be seen means that we are being divisive? 40 years after Combahee, we are still excluding trans women from our movements, still rooting ourselves in biology as a way to describe our lives, the same ways that white legislators and judges did to us when deciding whether or not we could be considered white and therefore citizens. And by we, I mean we, those of us who have not updated our feminism from the second wave when we are now in a fourth wave. 40 years after Combahee, we are still saying intersectional when actually what we mean is diverse and representational. Right. Yeah. I'm going to break that down. As my friend Rashad Robinson from Color of Change is known to say, we are still mistaking presence for power, and that mistake is killing us. 40 years after Combahee, feminism is still seen as a threat, and that, I think, is a good thing. If we do our jobs right, feminism will be the biggest threat to patriarchy, to sexism, to economies that are racialized and gendered, to democracies that are racialized and gendered. Feminism should be a threat to all of that. But I don't say all of these things to shame us. I say it to tell us the truth because I love us. And I think that we should be winning. I think that we have worked hard to win. But in order for us to get there, we have to make different mistakes. I'm going to say that again. In order for us to get there, we have to make different mistakes. Because it is unconscionable that in 2016, we are fighting still. Still. For the rights of women, all women, to be treated as human beings. It's unconscionable. It's unconscionable that we are still parsing out our lives in single issues. When black women have been telling us for more than 40 years that our lives are not just about whether or not we have access to abortion. That our lives are not just about whether or not we can close the wage gap between men and women. When our lives are not just about reaching the middle class. That's not what feminism is about.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Alicia Garza is speaking at the Maine Women's Summit on Economic Security in Augusta.
Black Lives Matter is able to be here because of the Combahee River Collective, because of the work that our sister Loretta Ross has been doing for decades, because of the ongoing ways in which black women have loved us enough. And I really do think it's like a deep, profound love. The ways that black women have loved us enough to say, hey, check this out. If we're going to get free, all of us, then we have to stop using the experiences of white women as the experiences of all women. That doesn't mean your experiences aren't important. It means you're not the center of the universe. And black women have loved us enough to say that gently, over and over and over again, for a feminism that could free us all. Now, let me just get specific. I stay up at night thinking about what we're up against and how to fight it. And what keeps me up is that black women, our experiences, really serve as canaries in the coal mine, if you will. What's happening to black women, what's been happening to black women, is a signal about what's in store for everybody. Particularly women of color, immigrant women, and poor women. We know already that black women are 3 times more likely than white women to be the head of their household with children under the age of 18. Black folks are always being told that if you work hard, you can succeed. And if you're not succeeding, it's because you're not working hard enough. But black women make 64 cents on average to every dollar that white men make. 64 cents. So that means hard work doesn't pay. 62% of all food prep and service workers are women. And food prep and service workers earn about $18,000 a year. Black women are the majority of these workers, concentrated in low-wage jobs with little opportunity to advance. Black women are 88.5% of the caregiving workforce, Women, as a whole, 88.5% of the caregiving workforce. Black women are 35% of that 88%. 5%. Caregivers make on average $24,000 a year. Black women have high rates of wage theft, race and gender-based income inequality, high rates of exposure to sexual harassment and sexual violence, unfair work scheduling practices, and limited access to paid leave. Black women workers experience twice the rate of wage theft as white women workers do. We're also more likely than white women to be incarcerated, and we are the fastest growing segment of the population in prisons and jails in this country. The reasons why: defending ourselves against attackers who are often intimate partners, or what are called, I don't know if I like this term, let me say it this way, economic crimes. Crimes of trying to figure out how to feed your family, passing a check that doesn't clear. Black women are more likely to be sexually assaulted by police as opposed to being murdered by them. As we saw in the case of Daniel Holtzclaw, who raped or otherwise assaulted 13 poor black women that we know of because they were poor and black. 47% of black transgender people have been incarcerated and are twice as likely to experience police violence. And the average life expectancy of a black trans woman is 35 years old. So, black women are hard at work, but in this society, hard work doesn't pay. And to make matters worse, we are moving to criminalize black women, funneling us into low-wage jobs. We're working harder to do that than we are to lift up black women so that all of us can get lifted. Economically, that is. Now, what keeps me up at night is knowing that these are the conditions that black women are facing, and the administration that we currently have, besides having a pussy grabber for president, we have an administration that has an agenda to further deepen these cleavages. They've just cast a wider net now. The Combahee River Collective and the long fight for women's liberation has been challenged over and over again by women of color and black women who have challenged feminism to have a more expansive view of what full equality and dignity really looks like, raising the important issues of race and nationality, class, sexuality, as the movement that was supposed to be fighting for the dignity of all women turned a blind eye to the sterilization of black and Puerto Rican women while supposedly championing reproductive rights and self-determination. Trans women, and particularly trans women of color, have challenged cisgender feminists like myself to have a more nuanced understanding of the potential of feminism. But y'all, we're still doing that same thing where we're saying women make 78 cents to every dollar that a man makes, completely neutralizing it, making it colorblind. I know this because black women make 64 cents to that 78 cents. Latinas make 58 cents to the 64 cents black women make and the 78 cents that white women make, and if we were to go down the line, where do you think trans women would be? It's for that reason that Black Lives Matter exists. It's not an intellectual exercise in identity politics, as both Democrats and Republicans would tell you. It's literally the fight for life and death. What we've learned is that placing women in leadership by itself doesn't further feminism. Even placing women of color in leadership doesn't further the aims of feminism. Intersectional feminism requires deepening our practice of building connections and relationships that expose us to the wide range of experiences that women are having in this economy and in this democracy. Our struggle is not to place more women at the head of Fortune 500 companies. That is not feminism. Our struggle is ending the exploitation of all genders in the workplace. Our struggle is not about just having more women in power. It's about transforming how power operates, transforming our practice from power over to power with. Our struggle is about redefining reproductive freedom to be about more than just abortion and childbearing, but seeing our central fight as supporting women in their choices to build whatever kind of family they want or not. Which means supporting all families. Heterosexual families, queer families, immigrant families, to be afforded the right to keep our families together, to be afforded the right to have our children actually become adults without undue interference by state-sanctioned violence in the form of immigration control, in the form of deportations, in the form of ICE raids, in the form of the drug war. Intersectional feminist leadership fights like hell for all black lives, not just the cisgendered male ones. Intersectional feminism affirms that trans women are women. Intersectional feminism affirms that an economic system that is fed by and based on, in part, the labor of black women, the genocide of indigenous women, and the theft of their land can never, ever, ever afford us the kind of world that we deserve. Intersectional feminism fights for a redistribution of resources and power, not just access to it. In closing, I think that we deserve more than inclusive feminism. Inclusive means you get to sit in the same room, but it doesn't necessarily mean that our issues, our experiences are intertwined and that we fight for each other. Intersectional feminism is grounded in and led by those who are directly impacted by these systems of domination that shape our lives. It is shaped by a worldview that there's enough for everyone, and that when everyone has enough, there's more possibility for dignity and respect for everyone. I think intersectional feminism and an intersectional feminist agenda is transformative. It's transformative because it transcends gender binaries. It's anti-racist, and it aims for more than just placing women on top. It means that we abandon fragility in the service of what might be possible to move through the pesky barriers that keep us from making new mistakes and that keep us from building a deep solidarity and collusion with each other. And I use the word collusion intentionally. If we are to disrupt what is happening in our country today, we have to reach out to each other. We have to reach out to each other. I pray and I work every single day to make sure that the feminist movement that I help to build is a movement that casts the net that is so wide that it's not just for women, that it is a movement that men see themselves as a part of as well. I hope that the intersectional feminist movement that I help to build is one that is courageous enough not just to get the orange person out of office, but every single person who stood by him. Every single person who stood and continues to stand by him, defending a vision for this country that not only moves us backwards, that's like not even the worst part of it. It's that they aim to destroy this country and build a new one in their image, white and male and Christian. Not the liberatory Christian, but the Christian that wants to conquer every other society and dominate it. I hope that the feminism that we build doesn't just place more women in office. And yes, there should be more women running this country. But women with a vision for what's possible for us when we really stand together, all of us, all of us. So, really in closing, I believe in us so much that I continue to get on stages like this and remind us that all lives matter is not a thing. Of course, all lives matter. If we really want to have that in practice, we've got to start fighting for all lives against every distortion, every attempt to neutralize, erase, water down. We've got to say, no, this isn't about disrespecting the country, the flag, the military, the police, none of that. This is about people dying. We have to be strong enough to do that. So, I believe in us. I believe in us. I believe in our ability to get free together. It's with that that I say thank you for having me, and let's build the movement we deserve, y'all. Thank you.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Now, Alicia Garza answers questions from the audience.
Okay, so first question.
Cool.
Maine is a very white rural state. We all know that.
Okay. Yes, we know.
Great. Do you have advice for those who are working to organize around racial justice issues in a mostly white, often rural state?
We're just talking about this today. Yes. One, don't be afraid to do it. And it seems very basic, but I think one of the things that tends to keep folk from having hard conversations is that we're afraid we're going to do it wrong. We're going to make a mistake. We're going to say the wrong thing. We don't want to alienate people. We don't want to turn people off. We don't want to beat people over the head with our politics. We have to be courageous enough to do it. Yeah? To have the conversation, to listen a lot. A lot, a lot. So we don't want to do that thing, right, where it's like, I'm more woke than you, and you're just going to sit and listen to me berate you for how unwoke you are. That does not make a woke society. But listening to what's happening underneath and calling up what hasn't been said, what's too scary to say, is really important. Now, the reason that I emphasize please have the conversation is because you can do things that I can't. You can do things that I can't. I wish that I could be as effective as white folks talking to other white folks, because then that's like all I would do. Right? Seriously. But why it matters that you do have the conversation is because somewhere along the way, not only are we, the folk who are getting activated around fear, fear of what we don't know because we live in segregated communities, fear of what's happening to this country, fear of being left out and being left behind. Those are very powerful, powerful things that encourage action. When we think about and we watch, right, all the things that are happening in this country, whether it be, you know, 59 people being murdered in Las Vegas, right, or whether it be 9 people being murdered in a church, all of that is being driven by fear of being replaced, as we heard in Charlottesville, fear of being left behind, or just fear of that which you don't know and seems and feels like a threat. So we got to dig in, because it is the folks that we're not having conversations with that are sending me death threats. For real, we shouldn't just think about folk as like, you know, crazy people behind a computer in a dark basement somewhere. These are our friends and family. We have to sit with that. We all have people in our families that we know. We just kind of go, they're rough. But we have to do more than that.
What is your opinion on the Women's March and its lack of trans and Black Lives Matter inclusion?
Well, the question was, what's your opinion of the Women's March and its how it included or not trans women and Black Lives Matter? Okay, so human rights, yes. It's important. And I think it's a way for us to connect. I don't mind the phrase human rights. I don't use it, but it doesn't mean I'm opposed to it. And it, when it's in a context internationally, I feel like it has a lot of resonance for me. I think that sometimes we can use the phrase human rights in this country to absolve ourselves of responsibility around inequities around race and gender and class. We get to say human rights instead of the rights of Black people and not whisper it. You know what I mean? So I'm more interested in how do we bring those things together. When I talk about dignity, I mean human rights. So it's not an intentional not using it, but I have flags around it. And I think that it's also an entry point for some people that should not be dismissed or erased. Women's March. The Women's March did include trans women and Black Lives Matter. I know that because I helped to write the platform, right, under which people united. And I know that because in places where Black Lives Matter exists and there's not a lot of infrastructure for organizing, our folks were heading and leading those marches, sister marches and local marches. I have a lot of love and respect for the folk like Tamika and Linda and Carmen and Bob who said, none of this is going to go forward without making sure that we do what we can to complexify what this march is really about. And I can tell you honestly that they worked really hard. And it wasn't just them. It's a lot of people who worked really hard to make sure that people were not erased. And I'll be honest when I say it's a both and. Some of our folks didn't show up because of old hurts and wounds that we have yet to heal, which is why I keep emphasizing this thing around intersectional feminism. A lot of our folks didn't show up because we didn't trust y'all. To keep it a buck, right? Keep it a buck means keep it 100, keep it real. Okay. And so I wrote a whole thing about it, right? I wrote a whole thing about what cynicism does to our movements. But I also wrote a whole thing about how not being cynical doesn't mean we're not holding people accountable for the ways in which folk continue to get excluded. Because in some ways, what we also saw was that as folk were trying to be a part of local marches, they were being told all the things that I told you just now. Oh, you're being divisive. Why do we have to bring race into it? This is about gender, right? Like all these things. Y'all, we gotta make new mistakes. I'm tired of these old ones. I want new ones. I want new conundrums to try to figure out. This one is old as time, and I want us to be able to say we were the ones who put those debates in museums where they could be examined and revered as relics, but that they're no longer the centerpiece of what we're grappling with. We have stuff to do. We have stuff to do. Therefore, I want us to get more literate and more comfortable saying the economy is racialized and gendered, and if you're not coming up, I'm not coming up. So it's all of us or nobody gets it, right? I want us to get more comfortable in that. And until that happens, until and unless that happens, let me say it that way, we're not going to get rid of this president. We're not going to get rid of this administration. I think that we are in for another 8 years, not just of Trump. And I don't say that to be a downer. I'm just like keeping it 100. We have another 8 years of him. We're mad, but the people who voted for him are not. See why we got to be doing different stuff? We're mad, but the people who voted for him are not. So, I'll leave that there and say again, thank you for having me, and go get him today, y'all. We're counting on you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Alicia Garza, a co-creator of the Black Lives Matter movement. She recently spoke at the Maine Women's Summit on Economic Security in Augusta. You can listen to the program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on Radio to access the program, and you'll see also many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. And for Speaking in Maine, I'm Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.